Okay. Well, I suggest we start by taking our usual period of quiet to settle ourselves down and make ourselves receptive to what we are about to consider. Amen, or whatever you want to say. Well, we have two speakers today, Ernie Tominga and Dennis Rivers. Dennis hasn't arrived yet. So, he's on his way. We know he's on his way, but he may have been delayed a little bit. So, I guess I will introduce Ernie now. We were going to do a blessing for both of them and do then an introduction, but I'm going to introduce Ernie and then we can bless him. Ernie Tominga is a trained spiritual director, a member of the board and teaching faculty of Still Point, the Center for Christian Spirituality. He holds a PhD in cross-cultural religious studies from UCSB, where he had the privilege and delight of studying for 5 years under the mentorship of Rimon Panikkar. He is a long time, and his note came with a long, long time. He wants you to know he's been there a long time. He's a long time student of the works and vision of Teilhard de Chardin, and indeed his doctoral dissertation was a study of Teilhard's thought. A lifelong multitasker, Ernie also has had a career in technology and is the co-owner of the videography business, Performance Memories. He is currently in the midst of his fifth term as an elder at Goleta Presbyterian Church. He and his wife, Allison, and I know I saw Allison here somewhere today. There she is, back at the table. Have 12 grandchildren, ranging in age from 1 year to 25 years old. And as a note, Ernie and Dennis have been friends for over 40 years. So that's impressive. Okay, so Ernie, we'd like to have you come up and we will sing our blessing.
We bless you as you share your gifts of spirit, light, and insight. We
I'm wearing a lavalier mic. Can you hear me? Okay. I will talk louder, and Tom might turn it up just a little bit, but we don't want feedback. If it comes to that, I can move to the middle mic. One of my goals in speaking is to try to wean myself from a lectern, so I want to be able to wander around a bit today, if you don't mind. I'm going to go right into the slides that I'm using. In the warm-up minute, I will mention, I think probably everybody got the email, that the speakers from last week asked that even though their talk will be up on the Word and Life website, that we don't share it to social media. It's possible, I know, to set up a link in Facebook to another website, so please do not do that. It'll be on the Word and Life website to listen to, which I certainly plan to do. I really liked what they said last week, and especially the way they said it. If my voice gets a bit inaudible, go like this or something, and I'll talk louder. Okay. The star field on these slides, as I think we already know, is not really on the slides. That's an artifact of the projector somehow. So they look nice, but they're not intentional. I'm going to go right into the slides. My chapter in our book is The Soul of the World, by Bill Plotkin, and I will hew fairly closely to that chapter, although I will riff on a fair amount as well. But I think he has some really interesting and important points in the chapter. And so I will, more than once, put up some quotes from the chapter. The arc of the presentation this morning will go through grief and bliss, despair and inspiration, elderhood and emergence. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on grief, but I do want to acknowledge the state of the world. Last year, early summer, I attended a week-long seminar at Ghost Ranch in New Mexico entitled Earth Honoring Spirituality. One of the presenters there was a young woman who is, I'm not sure exactly what her specialty is, but she studies birds and their songs. And she made a presentation which I'll mention a little bit more in just a minute. Another one of the participants in that seminar, a colleague, not a presenter, but someone else who was there as I was, named David Weiss. After he went home from the seminar, he wrote a little reaction to something that the woman that I mentioned had said, and I separately wrote a little one also. I'd like to share those both. His is called Bee for Bird. He says, "No happy tale, this one. Several years back, if I cry, don't be embarrassed, support me. Several years back, the American Museum of Natural History was hiring an ornithologist, a bird expert. This was one of the most prestigious positions for an ornithologist in the world, and the candidates were numerous, and they were all top tier. When the search had been narrowed down to the final six candidates, each was invited to make a presentation on the bird that was the focus of their research. At that point, a sobering realization emerged. Of the six candidates, four were studying birds that had gone extinct during the time of the study. Life evaporating before the very eyes. We are not perched on the edge of an extinction event. We have begun the cascade down the hill. As a direct result of this ominous intersection of human expertise and species extinction, the museum added a dimension to their exhibits that treats the spiritual and religious facet of species loss, recognizing that this isn't simply a historical event, it's an existential one." That was David Weiss. My own shorter response: recalling the presentation at Ghost Ranch, and she played for us recordings of the songs of birds who no longer sing. Who sing no more because they're gone. Gone in the blink of an eye, between the time of the recording and the time of our listening. We listen too late. We learn much too slowly, if at all. We are increasingly alone, stranded by our own hand. That's the extent of my dwelling on grief for this morning, but did want to acknowledge it, because that's a dimension of what we've been doing this semester. We are exploring our deep connections with the natural world, In fact, the way we say that is even a little bit misleading, because it's not just that we're here and we're connected with the world. We are each other. And that comes out in this chapter by Bill Plotkin as well. To be in a pivot from grief toward what I hope winds up being more hope, I want to show you very briefly the same man that I read from a moment ago about the bird researchers also wrote this little book called When God Was a Little Girl. And it's really delightful. I don't have any copies here except my one copy, which he autographed for me. It'll be back at the table if you want to take a look at it, but it's not for sale. It is for sale elsewhere, and if you look it up, I'm sure you could find a copy. It's a really delightful little book. Well, there's the cover. I personally also take some hope in the fact that among the New York Times and other list bestsellers these days are some books that really address the interconnection of us with all of our planet mates. This one was a New York Times bestseller, The Hidden Life of Trees. I believe several of you have already read this book. It's really interesting how the consciousness of trees, not the same as the mind of a human, but that doesn't mean they don't have consciousness. The way they communicate, the way they plan for the future, how much sugar conversion to do to get ready for the next season, anticipating what the next season might be like. These are conscious beings, co-conscious beings. Another book, this one coming out soon, I haven't read this one yet, by the same author, The Inner Life of Animals. And judging by the writing in the one about trees, I expect this is a wonderful book as well. I will soon have read it.
If you translate his name into English, it's The Rock Living Well.
Voleben? The Rock Living?
Living Well, yes.
Living Well. That's nice. That's nice. Another recent bestseller, and I love this cover, Beyond Words, What Animals Think and Feel. The way the author, Carl Safina, I think that's how you pronounce it, the way that he frames the approach is that when we look at an animal, we shouldn't ask, what's that? We should ask, who is that? Because they are subjective beings as well. And this book is full of stories that illustrate how deeply self-aware animals are, especially the chapter on elephants. Highly recommend that. And again, I take hope in the fact that this is a international bestseller. So my specific topic today is living the soul of the world, or living as the soul of the world. As Christians, we can begin with the event that began our specific tradition, the incarnation. Becoming embodied in the world. The event chronologically before the incarnation is the Annunciation. And usually, depictions of the Annunciation really emphasize angel. Aunt Mary is there, but she's, if anything, kind of passive and not really part of the picture except in agreeing to what she's being asked to do. But the angel is usually emphasized. Allison and I were in Ireland a few years ago, and at one of the cathedrals that we visited, there was on temporary display another depiction of the Annunciation, which I really love. We don't even see the angel. We see Mary in her full humanity. Something's going on, and something is issuing light, as we can tell by the shadow behind her. But the emphasis is on Mary in her humanness. Sorry? I have the painter's name at home. I'm sorry I didn't bring it. I can email it. So incarnation, the beginning of our Christian tradition, is the incarnation. But I'm not sure where this phrase came from, in the world but not of it. It's not part of Judeo-Christian tradition, because in Jewish tradition they don't consider themselves separate from the world. But somehow when it became Christian tradition, we often hear this emphasized. But I add the two question marks after it. Are we in the world but not of it? I don't think so. And our theme this semester does not think so. Here's a quote from Bill Plotkin. By human soul, I mean an individual's personal ultimate place in the more than human world. More than meaning not better than, just that it includes more than just us humans. His or her place in the earth community, and not just in a human society. That's his definition of soul, a human soul. So in the world, but not of it, no. Not by this definition. There are quite a few quotes from Plotkin in these slides. Here's another. A thing's ultimate place is its place in the great scheme of things, its quintessential place in the world or in the universe. Soul, then, is the place that most centrally and comprehensively identifies a thing. A thing's truest place, the very core or heart of a thing's identity. That's directly from this week's chapter. There we are at home. I'm going to emphasize this a number of times this morning. Plotkin's definition of soul is as a place, ultimate place in the world. And defined that way, everything has a particular place in the world. And so everything in this sense, still quoting Plotkin, everything in this sense has a soul. Every creature, mountain, river, valley, stone, flower, child, even every book, piano, house, teacup, every organization, like this one. I'm wearing my sign of belonging to Word and Life this morning. Every religion and every science, everything has a soul, if we define soul as our ultimate and truest place in the world. Emphasizing again, ultimate place in the world. And the way that he defines soul gives us a really interesting conceptual or mystical inversion of the way that we usually think about soul. Because following Plotkin, my soul is not something that exists in some compartment inside of me. Rather, my soul is my place in the universe. That's a really interesting inversion of the way that we usually think of soul. I don't know how our speaker from 2 weeks ago pronounces her first name. Rattle? Okay. In the Rattle or Rattle, I heard a couple of opinions. In the meditation that she led for us when she presented a couple of weeks ago, she had us experience the breathing of our breath. And then she kind of turned that around as well. And she said, experience your breath breathing you. In a parallel way, we could say, in a meditation, experience your awareness of your own consciousness. And then experience consciousness being aware of your awareness. That goes with that inversion of the place and meaning of soul. Consciousness being aware of my awareness. Plotkin expands on his definition by noting, the difference between caring for the world and caring for the soul of the world is the difference between ecology and spiritual ecology, the name of our book, or deep ecology, in what he calls patho-adolescent cultures, in which he includes ours, definitely. In patho-adolescent cultures, caring for the world, when contemplated at all, means contemplating what best serves humanity in our immediate egocentric needs, independent of the needs of other species or peoples, or even our own grandchildren. That's one unfortunate definition of caring for the world. That's the way that a patho-adolescent culture cares for the world. In contrast, when we place our emphasis on the soul of the world, we embrace the world as sacred, with its own essence, purpose, and destiny that might well be different, bigger, and more mysterious than anything we suspect or anything we could understand. That would be the spiritual, ecological meaning of caring for the world. We care for the soul of the world. We are of the soul of the world. I like his observation too. The soul of a possible true democracy, or better, a future biocracy, nice word, might be the affirmation of the inalienable rights of all species and all habitats. The world needs us to recognize its sacredness and to discover and inhabit our sacred roles in its evolutionary unfolding. The world needs us to recognize its sacredness. It's not just a nice spiritual thing to do for us. The world needs us to recognize that soul. Here's another observation from Plotkin that I really like this. The first time you consciously inhabit your ultimate place, which means inhabit your soul, the first time you consciously inhabit your ultimate place and act from your soul is the first time you can say, here. Really know what it means. The first time you can say, here, and really know what that means. Here. Here we are. Moving into his discussion of elders, which is kind of the second mainstream in his essay, he says, when we're young, what our ego doesn't know is our ultimate place, or our soul. Once in a while you run into a young person who seems preternaturally wise, but they're fairly unusual. More often than not, the stereotype anyway is, when we're young, what our ego doesn't know is our ultimate place, or our soul. Elders, in general, might be said to have the place of guardians of nature, culture, and the anima mundi, the soul of the world. Plotkin recognizes that elderhood is not necessarily only a chronological stage of life. But speaking as an older person in an audience mainly of older people, I will emphasize that we are, I think, particularly eligible to be wise. Elders in general, to say again, might be said to have the place, I want to emphasize place, the place of guardians of nature, culture, and the anima mundi. Referring back to an earlier quote then, by human soul I mean an individual person's ultimate place in the more than human world, and so forth. So, given that as kind of a syllogism, elders in general might be said to have the place of guardians of nature, culture, and the anima mundi. And if the place, the ultimate place that we inhabit, is our soul, we can say, as an elder, your guardianship is your soul. A true, this is quoting again, a true elder is someone who, after many years of adulthood, consistently occupies her ultimate place without any further effort to do so. You naturally live from your soul if you really become an elder. This frees him, he switches pronouns, so I am too. This frees him for caring for the soul of the world, not just for my egocentric understanding of soul as something that I own. A true elder is someone who is free to care for the soul of the world. To continue that quote, second paragraph here, she does this, she cares for the soul of the world by assisting others to discover and embody their souls, their places in the world, and by supporting the more than human community of Earth in the evolution of its soul. That's a true elder. We heard from a couple of true elders last week, yes? The elder within us, this is paraphrasing a paragraph from Plotkin, the elder within us feels our interdependence with all life and how we are summoned into existence through our relationships with all other beings. We see how each species, each habitat, and each social issue is related to all the others. I'm going to mention just in passing a tiny thumbnail of a kind of a disturbing movie I saw last week called Annihilation. By the title of it, I thought it was going to be a superhuman Guardians of the Galaxy, blow everything up kind of movie. It's not. There are some violent scenes. But in the film, what Annihilation turns out to be referring to is the breaking down on the cellular and even more level and the becoming something else. It's a perplexing movie, but I think it came to mind because this picture looks like, there's a scene in the movie where the main characters are approaching their ultimate goal, which I won't give away. And surrounding the area where they are, there are a number of figures just kind of in various different positions, frozen in positions, and they're obviously human, or at least they were, But at this moment, they're all made of flowering vines instead. I still haven't figured the movie out, but it moved me. Elders' hearts naturally break open of the world. And naturally rejoice with each awakening of life. Our souls intertwine. We're all part of each other and the more than human world. Our truest places have no boundaries. We are co-inheritors of the wisdom of all beings. That's our rightful legacy, both to us and from us. With wisdom to spare and wisdom to share. So let's claim our elderhood. I'm going to finish with about an 8-minute video that is still on this same theme that we've been exploring all semester. Oh, this video happens to be available in our little store where Allison is. It's in book form as well, A Prayer for Our Planet. This book is also back there. You saw this one a couple of years ago about the connection when you look into someone's eyes. These are both back there, both in book form and video form. So this is A Prayer for Our Planet. It's another day on Earth, and here I am. I'm right here. Some people say they're in the world, but not of it. That's not me. I'm in the world, I'm in your world, and I'm of it. In fact, not only am I of it, I'm made of it. Just like it says in the creation stories of most of the world's religions, just like it says in the creation story of science, evolution. Some people say, you made the world, and then you called it good. I say, yes, and you're still making the world. You're still making it right now, and you invite us to make the world with you. And you invite us to see that it is good. That's our work, renewing the earth. It's our work to see just how good it is. It's our work to see beauty and to create beauty. It's our work to recognize goodness and to live in goodness. It's our work to discover truth and to live in truth. That's how we renew the earth. That's how we do our work. It's not always easy, God. Sometimes it's really, really hard. I'm made of the earth. I see ice caps melting, and I feel my flesh on fire. I'm made of the earth. I see the bleaching of coral reefs and feel my bones turning
brittle.
I'm made of the earth. I see fertile land turning to desert, and I feel my skin withering. I'm made of the earth. I see species dying, and my whole body cries out. And yet, I see sunrise and sunset in all their glory, and they make me sing. I see the leaves of plants praying in the sun, and I feel your love. I watch birds and butterflies in flight, and they lift my heart. I watch animals and insects going about their lives, and I'm filled with compassion and admiration. People, even unto death, and I tremble with shame for my species. I see people killing people, and I hear them say, they do it in your name. And it makes me weep, as surely as it makes you weep as well. Because killing people in the name of God is absolute blasphemy. And yet, I look into the eyes of a baby and see the dawn of your creation. I see people helping people, and I feel your presence. I witness an act of kindness, or even a simple, surprising act of politeness. And I think, my species is, after all, capable of reflecting your grace. And in all the pain and all the inspiration, in all I experience in life on this glorious planet, above all, what I feel is gratitude. And so I pray, O God, creator of the universe, sustainer of all, I offer my prayers of thanksgiving for my birth in a world that fills me with wonder, for the beauties of earth, for each breath that I breathe. Thanks be to you, O my God. For the plants whose gifts feed my body, for the flowers that awaken my heart, thanks be to you, O my God. For the spiraling arms of our galaxy home, for the arms that embrace me in friendship or love, thanks be to you, O my God. For the most distant star in infinity's space, for the innermost flow of my thoughts, thanks be to you, O my God. For the ongoing power of creation itself, and the honor of living my part in its awakening, thanks be to you, O my God. For my ability here now to pray, thanks be to you, O my God. For each moment of silence as I rest in your grace. Thanks be to you, O my God. Hello, God. It's another day on earth, and here I am. It's another day on earth, and here we are.
When I came this morning, Tom Heck noted that a paragraph in the middle of Bill Plotkin's essay is very evocative of a good old song we all know. We're not going to do the song, but Tom will make the parallel here to finish our time for this presentation.
I know how to use mics. Sometimes. You know, I was reading page 208. The first paragraph is very much, it's what Ernie was talking about too. It's the concept of place, finding ourselves in the right place. And it brought to mind a song, and I just want to read this first to you. When I say everything has a place, I mean not its geographical location, but the role, the function, the station, the status, or the niche it has in relation to other things. A thing's place tells you how it fits in the world. And it goes on. Now, in 1848, an elder in the Shaker community, actually, wrote a poem and a song, and it's called Simple Gifts. And it talks about place. It says, 'Tis a gift to be simple, 'tis a gift to be free, 'tis a gift to come down where we want to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, it will be in the valley of love and delight. Isn't that gorgeous? When true simplicity is gained, to bow and to bend we shan't be ashamed. To turn will be our delight, till by turning we come round right.
Thanks, Tom. Last thing I want to mention from our little store is a bumper sticker that I had made, which I think goes along with our theme, water is sacred, drink deeply.